This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Jim Bertel. The EU and Britain have reached a post-Brexit trade deal, ending months of haggling. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson called it a good deal for the whole of Europe. And EU Chief Ursula von der Leyen said the deal is fair and balanced. Yet Johnson says it was a difficult path to reach this deal.
Although, of course, the arguments with our European friends and partners were sometimes fierce. This is, I believe, a good deal for the whole of Europe. And for our friends and partners as well.
Next, the British Parliament will vote on it. It will also need ratification by the European Parliament. The full text of the trade agreement is expected to be published soon. The agreement takes away the threat of tariffs between Britain and its biggest trading partner. Negotiations were the toughest over what EU fishing boats are allowed to catch in British waters. European Union fishing fleets will have to give up a quarter of their current catch in British waters over the next 5.5 years. Under the newly sealed trade deal, after a transitional period, access to Britain's rich fishing grounds would be negotiated on an annual basis. This represents a compromise. Early in the negotiations, Britain was pushing for an 80 or 60% cut in the EU's share, phased in over 3 years. The kidnapping of 344 schoolboys in northwest Nigeria had the appearance of an Islamist militant attack. There was even a video purporting to show some of the boys with members of Boko Haram, the extremists behind the 2014 kidnapping of more than 270 schoolgirls in the northeast. But four government and security officials familiar with negotiations that secured the boys' release told Reuters the attack was a result of intercommunal fighting over cattle theft, grazing rights, and water access, and not spreading extremism. This is VOA News. Republicans in the House of Representatives blocked a Democratic attempt Thursday to pass President Trump's demand for $2,000 in stimulus payments to millions of Americans who have been hard hit by the U.S. coronavirus pandemic. AP's Ed Donahue has more.
In his complaints about Congress's coronavirus economic stimulus bill, the president said the checks that would be handed out are too low. He wanted more.
Ridiculously low. $600 to $2,000.
The number two Democrat in the House, Steny Hoyer, agrees with the president.
$600 is certainly not enough for individuals who have been struggling 7 months.
But Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy says no, $2,000 is too much. The effort fizzled. Hoyer says just sign the bill.
The president of the United States, whether he's in Mar-a-Lago or any place else, ought to empathize with the pain and suffering and apprehension and deep angst that the American people are feeling.
The president has not said yet if he will veto the bill. Ed Donahue, Washington.
Mexico became the first Latin American country Thursday to launch a COVID-19 vaccination initiative, offering hope to a nation that has lost some 120,000 people to the pandemic. Chile will immediately start inoculations of healthcare workers after receiving the first 10,000 doses of a 10 million dose order of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine on Thursday. The United States is about to complete its second week of vaccinations with about 1 million inoculations, mainly among healthcare workers and elderly residents of nursing homes. The numbers, however, are far short of the goal set by Operation Warp Speed. The federal government's effort to mass produce millions of doses of vaccines to inoculate 20 million Americans by the end of the year. According to Johns Hopkins University, California has become the first state to record 2 million confirmed coronavirus cases. AP Shelley Adler reports.
California health officials say the grim milestone of 2 million COVID-19 cases is related to Thanksgiving gatherings. More than 18,000 people are hospitalized, and many of the state's intensive care units are filled. Dr. Jim Keeney is an emergency physician at Mission Hospital.
The biggest challenge is just taking care of all these patients. You know, on any given day, most emergency departments are already bursting at the seams.
Jenny Carrillo is a charge nurse at Holy Cross Hospital.
I look into the eyes of someone who's struggling to breathe, who's struggling to, you know, get well. They want to be home with their family.
Los Angeles County is leading the surge, accounting for 1/3 of the state's COVID-19 cases. I'm Shelley Adler.
For more on COVID-19 or any of today's top news, please go to voanews.com or use the VOA mobile app. Via remote, I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, December 25th, Christmas Day. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenyan doctors and their four-day nationwide strike.
The strike by Kenyan medical practitioners, pharmacists, and dentists union has now been called off. And there'll be no victimization of any member of KMPDU and all our members who have undertaken this action.
Ugandan authorities have charged lawyer Nicholas Opio with money laundering. Residents of the Kenya-Somalia border fear conflict amid diplomatic tensions. Malayan refugees return to camp they fled in Burkina Faso. And Burundi's government has been providing details about the pardon of four jailed journalists.
The four journalists have paid all the fines imposed to them. And during their detention, the government learned that they had an exemplary behavior.
And corruption makes Nigeria the world's biggest smuggler of ivory and pangolin skulls. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Kenyan medical practitioners, pharmacists, and dentists union has called off a four-day strike following what the group calls successful engagement with the government, resulting in the signing of a return-to-work formula. However, and as Atieno Odhiambo reports from Nairobi, the strike by nurses and clinical officers, which began December 7th, continues.
Kenya Medical Pharmacists and Dentists Union Secretary General Dr. Chibanzi Mwachonda made the announcement during a joint news conference yesterday, Thursday, with Health Cabinet Secretary Mutahi Kagwe and his labor counterpart Simon Chelugui. Dr. Mwachonda said they agreed to end the strike after assurances that the Treasury would fast-track funding for the doctors and that all union members would be provided with adequate personal protective equipment.
The strike by Kenya Medical Practitioners, Pharmacists and Dentists Union has now been called off, and there'll be no victimization of any member of KMPDU and all our members who have undertaken this action. The National Treasury will be required to fast-track funding for counties to procure a comprehensive group life, last expense, enhanced work injury benefits and group personal accident cover as provided for by NHIF, and also ensure that our members get comprehensive cover from the county.
Labour Cabinet Secretary Simon Chelugui said the government and the doctors arrived at a return-to-work formula after the government assured the doctors that all issues of concern to them would be addressed.
We have arrived at a return-to-work formula, and that all the issues that were raised and itemized have either been addressed or we have given assurance of action, and that me and the Minister for Health will facilitate engagement with any county government or any other department in government to ensure that this return-to-work formula is sustained.
Health Cabinet Secretary Mutahi Kagwe praised the medics for agreeing to the ministry's proposals, thereby ensuring the continuation of better health services to Kenyans.
So I want to be really, really thankful for the understanding that we have created. Going forward, we are looking not just at dealing at the matters that we have got here on the tables and the issues we are dealing with, but generally improving healthcare in the country. Working together, we can create a new paradigm for the health of Kenyans. There is no health that we can give Kenyans without health workers. And therefore, our soldiers on the front line, whether it is COVID-19 or whether there is any other disease, are resolved by our health workers.
Other things agreed on in the return to work formula include comprehensive insurance coverage, unconditional release of all with health salaries, as well as provision of adequate protective equipment to all doctors. However, the end of the doctor's strike does not necessarily mean that health services will return to normal in various parts of the country, as nurses and clinical officers are yet to call off their strike. Atieno Odhiambo, VOA Daybreak Africa, in Nairobi, Kenya.
Kenya and Somalia have agreed to try to reduce diplomatic tensions at a conference this week in Djibouti. Mogadishu cut ties with Nairobi last week over alleged interference with its sovereignty. Despite the attempts to de-escalate, the Somali government and a Somali region friendly to Kenya are building up troops in the border area, sparking fears of military conflict. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
There's growing concern the tensions between Kenya and Somalia may erupt into fighting due to a military build-up along the two countries' borders. The Somali federal government has sent troops to the border town of Beledweyne while forces from Somalia's Jubaland region, which enjoys a good relationship with Kenya, are stationed in the nearby Kenyan town of Mandera. Mohamed Maalim Mahmoud is a Mandera County Senator. He says his people should not bear the brunt of the bad diplomatic relations between the two countries.
We don't want a situation where these two forces fight and our people's life are endangered. We have now Kenya and Somalia, apparently their relations is not good for the last few days, but this should not be borne by the Mandera people.
Hundreds of fighters allied to Jubaland Interior Minister Abdirashid Janan have been stationed in Mandera for months. Last March, these forces launched a cross-border attack in Belathau, killing dozens. On Tuesday, Mandera residents took to the streets to demand the Jubaland forces to leave and stop endangering their lives. The protest took place after the Somali government sent hundreds of soldiers to secure the Belathau area. 50-year-old Jama Warsame is one of elders in Belathau. He says the residents of the town cannot afford to flee their homes this time of the year. Warsame says that during this time it is really hot, dry, and there is a drought. He says we are so much against any conflict this time. He says we would like to urge our government that is in control of the area to find a solution and reach an agreement with those who are opposing it so that they can enjoy the peace we have now. Last week, Somalia cut diplomatic ties with Kenya. The federal government accuses Kenya of interfering with its internal affairs, an accusation that Kenyan officials deny. George Musamali is the head of the Center for Risk Management in Africa. He says any conflict between Kenya and Somalia will be felt beyond the border area. For its part, the Jubaland government has insisted on the withdrawal of government forces in the neighbouring Gedo region, a demand that the government in Mogadishu has refused to accept. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
A Ugandan court has charged human rights lawyer Nicholas Opio with money laundering after his arrest Tuesday by plainclothes police. Opio's lawyer said the charges are political because of his support for opposition leader and presidential candidate Robert Chakulai, popularly known as Bobby Wine. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
The state alleges that on October 8th, at a branch of Absa Bank in Kampala, Nicholas Opio acquired $340,000 in the name of the human rights organization Chapter 4. Prosecutors say at the time, he knew the funds were proceeds of crime. Solomon Muita is the judiciary spokesperson.
That court does not have jurisdiction to handle that matter. So the magistrate just read the charges to him and remanded him to Chitalia prison up to Monday next week. His file is supposed to be transferred to the anti-corruption court, where the matter is going to be handled going forward.
Two of Opio's colleagues who were arrested with him have been released on bail. Opio's lawyer, Aaron Kiza, says the government just needed a holding charge to imprison Opio, but that this has nothing to do with his work.
They are harassing him for his passive support for Bobby Wine. It's not the money laundering. They know his books. They searched the house and they got nothing.
Activists say the state is criminalizing civil society work and persecuting civil society organizations and individual leaders. Uganda police spokesperson Fred Enanga says these allegations are unfounded and they should allow investigations to prove his innocence or guilt.
There is no activist who is above the law. If they are involved in suspicious activity, we have to investigate them to help disprove or prove some of these claims.
Opio, who is executive director of Chapter 4 Uganda, was arrested by plain-clothed police officers at a restaurant Tuesday evening. According to Chapter 4, at the time of his arrest, Opio was working on collecting evidence surrounding the killings and arrests that occurred after protests November 18th and 19th. The protests, sparked by the arrest of Wine, resulted in clashes between security forces and opposition supporters. 56 people were killed. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Friday, December 25th. Burundi's government has been providing details about the pardon of four jailed journalists. President Evariste Ndayishimiye Thursday forgave the four journalists, all with the Iwacu publications. They were arrested October 2019 while covering clashes between security forces and an armed group in Burundi's Bubanza province. They were charged with complicity in threatening the internal security of the country and sentenced to 2.5 years in prison. Wele Nyamitwe, chief of the Information and Communications Division at the Burundian State House, says the four journalists wrote a letter to President Ndayishimiye requesting for pardon.
First of all, I'd like to inform that the four journalists have written a letter to the President of the Republic of Burundi in which they have requested for a presidential pardon, and to which he responded favorably. In addition to that, Mr. James, the four journalists have paid all the fines imposed to them. And during their detention, the government learned that they had an exemplary behavior. And all these elements have been considered by President Evariste Ndayishimiye for their pardon.
What do you think this pardon means in terms of press freedom in Burundi in general?
Quite frankly, the four persons weren't jailed for being journalists. They were prosecuted for clear offenses, like any other citizen. So press freedom in Burundi is a reality, and nobody has been so far jailed for being journalists here in Burundi.
During the administration of the late President Pierre Nkurunziza, the Burundian government banned VOA and the BBC from broadcasting directly from Burundi. Is it fair to say that the pardoning of these four journalists could mark the beginning of a new chapter in terms of press freedom as it relates to international journalists?
Let me clarify. VOA was banned because there is an individual wanted by the Burundian justice for his alleged participation in the attempted coup in Burundi in 2015. And that person is employed by the VOA. On the other hand, the BBC was banned because it broadcasted a false report on Burundi. So the pardon of these four journalists has nothing to do with the functioning of Burundi in relation to the national or international media.
During his inauguration, President Ndayishimiye promised to bring about national unity. How do you think the president has done so far in this regard?
President Ndayishimiye is strengthening what already existed in terms of social cohesion and national unity, because, as you know, former President Pierre Nkurunziza contributed a lot in the consolidation of peace and national unity in Burundi.
That was Wele Nyamitwe, Chief of the Information and Communication Division at the Burundian State House. He was speaking with us from the capital, Bujumbura. The UN Refugee Agency says improved security has allowed 3,000 refugees from conflict-ridden Mali to return to a camp in Burkina Faso that they abandoned 9 months ago following attacks by armed extremists. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Some 9,000 Malians in Burkina Faso's Gudubo refugee camp fled in terror when they came under fire by armed extremists in March. About 5,000 made the difficult decision to return to Mali, a country still in turmoil. The UN Refugee Agency assisted them upon arrival. Many of the remaining refugees fled to the nearby town of Dori, where they've been living under dire conditions. UNHCR spokeswoman Shabia Mantu tells VOA that national authorities have reinforced security in and around Gudubo, making it possible for the refugees to return to the camp.
For the 3,000 that have returned back to the camp, they were relocated in 31 convoys of buses and trucks to the camp. So another 150 refugees arrived on their own in motorcycles or in tricycle taxis, and others moved on foot accompanying their cattle.
Mantu says another 2,100 refugees are expected to move back to Gudubo from Mentau camp this month. She says the Malians will have better access to services in the camp. She says 1,500 100 new shelters have been built, health clinics have been refurbished, schools are welcoming students, and returning refugees have begun reopening small businesses.
But despite the welcome relocations, we're continuing to warn that attacks by armed groups in the Sahel will lead to further displacement in a region that's already hosting 2 million IDPs and hundreds of thousands of refugees. Across the Sahel, refugees, internally displaced people and their hosts are subjected to brutal violence, rape, executions. It's really horrible. And now the COVID pandemic is adding a new layer of hardships.
Burkina Faso is at the epicenter of one of the world's fastest growing displacement and protection crises. The UNHCR says more than 1 million people in the country are internally displaced, and more than 20,000 Malians have taken refuge there. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Corruption has made Nigeria the world's biggest smuggler of ivory and pangolin kills from Central and West Africa to Asia, according to a report by the Environmental Investigation Agency. The London-based group says in the past 5 years, Nigeria has been implicated in a global seizures equating to 4,400 elephants and hundreds of thousands of endangered pangolins. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
We have just lost a rare endangered species known as the pangolin.
Aaron Olamilekan, a Nigerian wildlife advocate, spoke as he held a dead pangolin he bought from a group of local hunters arriving from a hunt on the outskirts of Abuja.
They tell me why most of them hunt. It's based on poverty. There's no good job. There's no government support for them. So they have no choice than to go into the wild.
The hunters sell the animals in exchange for cash, but Aaron sometimes intercepts them, negotiates and rescues endangered species. He runs a sanctuary where he says animals can be resuscitated and nurtured before they are released into the wild.
And the ecosystem is being tampered with because all these animals have a role to play in our environment. So killing them will cause a future disaster.
Illegal hunting for trade is the major reason that endangered species such as elephants and pangolins are in constant decline. Since 2015, Nigeria has been the main exit point for pangolin scales and elephant ivory from the continent to many parts of Asia, where they are prized for decorative purposes or their alleged but unproven medical uses. A recent report by the Environmental Investigation Agency, EIA, shows more than 30 tons of ivory and 167 tons of pangolin scales have been smuggled through the country in 5 years. The EIA blames corruption by Nigerian border and port officials for the illegal trade. Shruti Shores is a senior wildlife campaigner at EIA.
Corruption, which exists within certain public sectors, is helping organized crime to thrive and to traffic in ivory, pangolins, and several other species. We need political will at the highest level of government to prioritize this issue.
Nigeria is a member of several international conventions protecting endangered wildlife, including the Convention on International Trade of Endangered Species. Nigerian authorities continue to pledge their commitment toward protecting wildlife, even though laws meant to safeguard endangered species are rarely enforced. The EIA wants Nigerian authorities to take stricter measures against poachers and smugglers, noting that uncontrolled trade during this period of the coronavirus pandemic could be potentially dangerous. For the moment, wildlife advocate Aaron Olamilekan will be saving as many endangered animals as possible. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Christmas morning to you too, James. This Christmas will not be the most memorable for most sportsmen and women on the African continent as the second wave of COVID-19 infection forces cancellation and postponement of many sports events. In Malawi, there will be no Christmas for a 28-year-old man who died in Kasungu, central Malawi, after taking part in a drinking competition. The man, identified by the police as Brave Banda, who owned a bar, allegedly challenged customers in his bar that he could drink in succession 10 bottles of a gin containing 43% alcohol. If he succeeded in drinking the bottles, the customers watching will settle the bill. The Zimbabwe Herald reports that the man was rushed to Kamboni Health Center, where he died while receiving treatment. Elsewhere in Nigeria, the Nigerian Minister of Youth and Sports Development says he is excited that the 20th edition of the Nigerian Sports Festival, earlier fixed for January 3rd to the 17th, 2021, has been moved to the 14th to the 28th of February, 2021. Many athletes had kicked against the January date due to its proximity to the Christmas and New Year celebrations. Mr. Dari says the new date, coming close to the 2021 Olympics, will be beneficial to the Nigerian athletes as they prepare for the Olympic Games.
It is almost perfect for us when you look at the build-up to the Olympics. Because from that point, there's no let up. We're done with that, we'll come with the National Youth Games, okay? And then it just keeps our athletes, you know, the teams that will come in. We're going to work with the states. So I think we hope for the best.
Kenya international football star Michael Olunga has been crowned the most valuable player and top scorer of the Japanese J-League at the annual Japan Soccer League Awards ceremony held this week. He had an outstanding season, scoring 28 goals in 32 matches with his club, Kashiwa Reysol.
The season was quite long. It was quite different for the others because we had, you know, the coronavirus, and you know, we had to play in phases. But at the end of the day, you know, to have a consistent performance throughout the season, you know, it's really something impressive. And you know, I really thank everyone who supported me throughout the season.
Staying with football news, Mali internationals Mohamed Camara and Sako Keita have both tested positive for a banned substance following last month's African Cup of Nations qualifiers against Namibia. On Wednesday, the pair's club, Red Bull Salzburg, confirmed that both players had failed a mandatory UEFA inspection on the 22nd of November 2020, just days after they had returned to Austria following the international break. And that's your Christmas morning Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington, wishing you a Merry Christmas.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, December 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson Omale, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you and your families joyous holidays.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.